This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In this show, we'll cover growing your own food right where you are on a city lot with urban farming pioneer Jule Dervais. Then I'll ask author Richard Heinberg if the money system can survive the end of growth. But first, what if you face an emergency quite different than the TV told you? Whether it's a hurricane, a forest fire, or just unheard of blasts of rain or snow, I always wonder, how do so many people die in these things, even when they have a lot of warning? You and I are much too smart to be caught out in a natural disaster, aren't we? We're informed, we're prepared, we're not the type. Really? One of the smartest people I know has a tale to tell you about hurricanes, hubris, and hot water. Dr. Kathy McMahon is a psychologist, now specializing in, quote, the emotional reactions to peak oil, climate change, and economic collapse. And that's a quote from the masthead of her popular blog, Peak Oil Blues. Our interview last year was in the top 20 Radio EcoShock downloads. Let's find out how our conceptions can lead into danger and how to plan smarter for emergencies. Kathy, I'm really pleased to have you back on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You were in New England when Hurricane Irene came roaring through. Tell us what happened just getting caught out there and getting home.
Well, you know, the story is not all that fascinating to begin with because, like a lot of people caught in dangerous situations, we had no idea that the situation that we were caught in was as dramatic and dangerous as it was. We were at a friend's wedding in the middle of Vermont, and it was an idyllic day on Saturday, and we just had a lot of fun and stayed up late and decided that, you know, we're going to get up early, but with all of our reverie, we slept in a little bit later and left at 8 o'clock. And, you know, we were expecting the storm to hit a little bit later on, you know, maybe middle afternoon. So we headed home. And the one thing that we kept noticing was that we never got the really tropical force winds we were expecting. So we kept thinking to ourselves, well, the hurricane hasn't hit in this area yet. And then we would notice a tree would be down on the interstate. So we would slow down and kind of move around the interstate and keep going, and that happened on two different occasions. But still, we were continuing to wait for this tropical wind that was going to be so devastating and so dangerous. So we decided to stop for a gas, and we learned later, I have on my website a picture of the town Deerfield where we stopped to get gas, and it was raining, but again, no tropical force winds. We got the gas and decided that maybe we should take the quicker way home rather than the highway. So we started to do that and wind our way through some of the smaller streets in Western Mass, and lo and behold, we had to stop because a town became a river. The road was completely covered with rushing water. And at that point, we realized that we weren't in Kansas anymore. It was a shocking experience for us. And, of course, the road wasn't closed. We were able to drive right down there. And if we weren't looking, or maybe we're foolish enough to think that maybe we could cross the river that was once the highway anyway, or the road, we would be dead. But we turned around, and to make a long story short, we went the rest of the way on the highway that we could because we live in a hilly area. We had to take some smaller roads, and we were continually confronted with roadblocks, police barricades. And the longer that it took us to get home, the more dangerous it became. And like I said, only later on did we realize that the gale force winds we were expecting was not the true danger. The true danger was the flooding, and it wasn't something that was in our mental map to even recognize that that was what we needed to look out for.
And that's so interesting because we do have these mental maps, and people had it for that storm. They said, oh, it's going to knock out New York City, but it was really Vermont and the New England states that got hit so hard. What do you make of this phenomenon that we have a conception, and that actually can be dangerous for us when a real emergency arises.
Well, I think that we, our mind, our ability to imagine what is true from what is false, gives us a blueprint for what we should look for. And in my case, what we were looking for was serious wind. And so we took precautions and kept expecting to see serious winds. And later I found out that we aren't alone, that more than 80% of people in a hurricane are really worried about, very concerned about high winds, but only half of that 80%, 40%, are really concerned about flooding. And yet flooding is a much greater danger. So one of the things that I think is really important for anyone to realize when they're facing natural disasters like that is to be able to see what's in front of them as evidence for that danger and not to make assumptions that what they imagine is the danger is the only thing that could be out there. For them to be able to, moment by moment, assess what they're seeing and make a judgment on that and not stick with that image that they have in their mind about what is and what isn't dangerous.
And I think that's probably what kept certain humans alive over the ages and not others, is just to be there in real time and say, well, this is what's actually happening. It wasn't what I expected, but this is what is happening.
Yeah, rigid people are dangerous people in survival situations because they have a plan and they are going to stick to that plan come hell or high water.
And I don't know why George Bush comes to mind, but we won't go there. Well, in the larger scale of things, you had a second sort of learning experience when you arrived home because your base of operations, so to speak, wasn't ready either, even though you're kind of a prepper kind of person.
And again, all of these things seem mundane until an emergency happens. And when emergencies happen, even something as everyday as a house that isn't organized and cleaned in preparation, we had been busy on the property making sure that all the things on the outside of the property was picked up. We took any of the possible flying objects that could break our window. We took them and put them into a safekeeping. But we hadn't looked inside to decide what our life would be like if we had no electricity. So we had to do the setup, which we had, fortunately, of getting a camp stove up and running to heat hot water and that sort of thing. But we were also fighting against not knowing how long the electricity would be out. And one of the things that I think is really important is for people to recognize that putting things in order in their house when they're expecting something like a hurricane, cleaning, doing laundry, that sort of thing, is it's equally as important as, you know, getting their medications or getting water.
Right. The best way to be ready is to be ready. Well, on another front here, and I know you looked into this, what is the best way to die in a big storm? How do people go?
Oh, you know, I noticed with this particular hurricane that people die in a variety of ways, not the least of which is they think, for example, that they can make it as they're traveling through a puddle, and they find out differently. 6 inches of water is the deepest that many cars need to start to lose control. So we've had people in this hurricane get into accidents because they simply hit a puddle of water and lost control of their car and died. Or they had their car floating away and they actually drown in the car themselves. We also had people, a young boy, for example, and another woman die when a tree fell down on their house, crushed their roof, and crushed them. So, you know, old trees can kill you if they're hanging over your house. Electrocution is not uncommon. People will think that if they don't step on electrical wires, then they won't get hurt. But when it's raining, the water itself can, the electricity can travel through the water, and electricity itself can cause severe burns with people. And the other thing, and this is sort of dangerous in the sense that people don't think about it, so many of the deaths in hurricanes happen after the storm is over. When people are starting to clean up, they are without electricity, They can die from hypothermia, being overheated. They can die from carbon monoxide poisoning because they will power up their generators. And for many people, they're fearful that their generators will be stolen. So instead of putting it 50 feet away from their home, which is what's recommended, they'll put it in their garage or they'll put it in their basement. And quite a few people die every single year from carbon monoxide poisoning. And sometimes the reasons that they'll power up that generator is not for survival reasons, but because they're bored. They're trying to entertain children, or they're trying to, entertain themselves by watching television. Candles can burn their house down. Some people are going to be lighting in a variety of different ways, and candles start fires. Other kinds of burning items can cause fires, and even flooding basements themselves can be very dangerous. So I think that there's any number of ways that people can end up dead when it seems mundane. Even the hurricane itself may not to other people look like it was very severe, and yet somebody who's cutting a tree with a chainsaw in their driveway to move it away and only takes that chainsaw out once a year can severely cut their leg and have to rush to the hospital to get services. And if their road is out, they may well bleed to death unless they have medical attention right where they are.
Well, I think we've learned a lot already. I want to say this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the peak oil shrink, Dr. Kathy McMahon. We're talking about lessons learned from natural disasters, and they can strike anywhere. It could even be an earthquake or a tsunami, but these days more of these threats are supercharged by climate disruption. Wherever you live, maybe it's time to think about shelter and adaptation. Kathy, you brought up a really intriguing book about defensive gardening, I think. What is that?
It's by Charles Smith, and the name of it is The Weather Resilient Garden, A Defensive Approach to Planning and Landscaping. And one of the things I really like about this book is that it really is oriented towards any kind of climate that you live in. And the ways, you know, for our area, I was very concerned about forest fire. And so one of the things that we did, because we don't live in a very hot area, is that we cut down a number of trees within a certain number of feet around our house. And when we arrived home, I'll tell you, we were pretty relieved to know that we didn't have a tree hanging over our roof. So it's a book that's very helpful in being able to point out the kinds of natural disasters that can impact various areas and the types of landscaping that you should be considering doing in order to protect your home and your family from those kinds of disasters.
You know, I think I'm going to get that book. I would like to read it myself. Well, another big issue seems to be road damage. There were hundreds of bridges knocked out around New England alone, and people, even smart people, think they'll just drive out of a disaster, maybe in their SUV or a camper. Is that realistic from what you've just experienced?
Absolutely not. In fact, one of the decisions that we had to make is whether we were going to stay in that small Vermont town for another day and wait for the hurricane to pass, or we were going to drive home. And what we found out was that the groom's parents actually went out quickly to pick up something on the other side of town, and the bridge in the town went out, and they had to rent another hotel room because they weren't able to get back to their original one. And many towns in Vermont have actually been stranded, and they've had to fly in food and supplies. The bride tells me that in the hotel she was staying in, they were real very nice, and they had leftover food, and they were cooking it up for them. Very often, if you're not home and you're thinking that you can get home, I think that for us, one of the scariest moments was when we realized that we may not be able to get home, that we just had assumed once we got home we were fine. But the idea that the roads were closed, the roads were flooded, in some cases the roads just fell off. I mean, you'd drive and then all of a sudden there would be no road in front of you. It was absolutely terrifying.
Kathy McMahon, you also study economic distress. Are we at the point yet where some of this road infrastructure may not be repaired at all because governments at all levels, states, municipal, and the federal government certainly, because they're so broke?
Well, remember, this is the first hurricane of the season. And one of the things that we have to think about is perhaps in some of the major cities, these roads will certainly be replaced. But the farther out you get, the more remote the towns, the smaller the towns, the more strapped the federal government will be for funds, the less likely they'll be repaired to the standard that they may have been repaired 10 years ago. And then the next hurricane comes, and there's more road damage because it wasn't repaired fully and thoroughly the first time. We have the National Guard around our area right now, and we have a section of Route 91. Interstate highways are built to the standard to withstand 100-year floods. We have sections of an interstate highway that have washed out, that are not accessible to traffic, even today, Wednesday. So as a result, yeah, I think we will inevitably see a situation where not only towns and cities and even the federal government will have increasing difficulty in coming up with the funds to replace all of the damage that's done. But I think increasingly you'll also see insurance coverage and flood insurance becoming so prohibitive that people will be left living someplace that they can't sell because the next person who comes in will not be able to afford the flood insurance. And yet at the same time, when this damage happens, they won't have the funds to repair their home. So you'll end up seeing, I think, some homelessness as a result of this as well. In the town we were in, a photography studio, literally washed away. The entire building washed into the river. In that particular case, they had flood insurance. To some extent, they will be able to rebuild. I hear that right now there's thoughts that the insurance itself may pay 40% of the kinds of damage that this flood has caused. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what we'll see. We'll see people, you know, in a situation where increasingly they will repeatedly need to pay large deductibles in order to repair the damage that these storms are doing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We are talking the aftermath of Hurricane Irene with New England resident and psychologist Kathy McMahon. Find her blog at peakoilblues.org. Kathy, there have been hard times all through history. The last century went through a major depression and two ugly world wars. Do you think that we're coming into one of those really hard times now?
I think we're in it. I think that things are already difficult for a huge number of people. Unemployment is very high. There's a largest number of people on food stamps in the United States than has ever been on food stamps before. And I think increasingly you will see, as we're seeing now, states becoming increasingly bankrupt, cities that aren't able to pay pensions, people who've had the assumption that they will be comfortable in their retirement will suddenly be without those funds and have to rely on younger their kids and younger people, which will stress the entire family. So I think that sometimes when we think about a Great Depression, we really forget that during the last Great Depression, there wasn't a sign out that said, by the way, you're in a Great Depression. And people just learn to adapt and live through their everyday life. And I think that's what we're doing now, that each of us will think when we lose our job that it's a personal problem. And even though we'll hear and we'll read on the news and on wonderful programs like yours that unemployment happens, we still tend to personalize, and we have a very difficult time fathoming that this is happening on a global level. This is not simply a personal problem that affects each and every family to one extent or another.
Well, given that, Kathy McMahon, I can find a lot of survival how-to information on the net, but what I can't find so easily is how to cope with all this bad news and worry emotionally. What are some of the things you recommend for emotional preparedness?
Well, I think that the best thing that you can do is to be able to accept the fact that these are stressful times. And the problem is not that you're feeling anxiety. Anxiety is a perfectly appropriate reaction to uncertainty. The issue is how you'll deal with that stress, how you'll deal with that anxiety. And the first thing is to be able to accept the fact that you're going to feel that. And the second thing is to be able to learn the very many ways that are out there for coping with stress. And some of those ways are idiosyncratic. Some of those ways are positive and lead to you further having a clear mind and a healthy body. And some of those are going to lead to the opposite, drugs and alcohol being one of the exceptions. It may relieve the stress initially, but long-term, if it becomes a pattern of adapting. And of course, the other key thing is we need each other. People need to be able to get together more often in groups, in family set, extended family situations, in dances, that kind of thing. And I think, unfortunately, when we face stress, particularly when we face unemployment and that sort of thing, we tend to withdraw from those kind of social connections. So I think that just getting together with other people, having a dinner, socializing, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but being with other people and being able to commiserate or perhaps just have a mindless diversion can be a really useful way of coping with things.
And there you have it. Psychologist Kathy McMahon is one of the best out there, I think, when it comes to prepping the mind for future stress. Check out Kathy's blog at peakoilblues.org. Kathy, thank you for sharing your lessons learned from Hurricane Irene in New England 2011.
My pleasure.
Radio EcoShock.
Coming up next, City Farming. Feed yourself where you are. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock on Co-op Radio 100.5 FM, Vancouver. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the 1980s, when I was hacking away brush on a 200-acre homestead in Wayback Country, Jule Gervais and his family stayed home. They turned a city lot in Pasadena, California, into a food-producing mini-farm with a philosophy that anyone can do it. The Gervais family have defined a new way of sustainable city living. Jules Gervais, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So, how is the harvest this year?
Okay, well, I say it's up and down. We're experiencing shocks this year that we've kind of never had before. So it's a new experience for us. We thought we had our act together. That's always the optimism in me, but we've seen quite a bit of problems. There's been of course, the weather gyrations, but we've had more than our share of downs. This looks like it'll be a down year. We have up and downs for the last 10 years, but this one will be a when it gets to the end, when we tally the produce January 1st, it'll probably be one of our lower years.
And how much do you normally produce in a year, just to give our listeners an idea?
Okay, well, we started out with 2,300 pounds back in 2001, and our highest we got was in 2010 was 7,000 pounds of fruits and vegetables on a tenth of an acre garden. And in between, it's been all over the place. But this, what bothers me now is we should be getting better, and yet we can't really control the weather. So it's like it's new to us what nature throws at us.
It's terrible here in British Columbia. The spring was just so late and so wet and so cold. A lot of people are complaining they just couldn't get their crops to fruit properly and other problems.
That's correct. I mean, we're the same thing here, except in the other way. We got too dry. Everything that we have is almost extreme. So they call it global weirding instead of global warming. It's you get it all around the country, all around the world, is that there's no one mean temperature or low or high where you can average it out. It's way spiking all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least we're not in Texas where they don't get any rain at all.
Yeah, they really spike in bad there. I mean, with the wildfires now, they're paying for years of drought. With on top of that, they get fire, yeah.
Well, you're still talking about a lot of food this year. What do you do with it all?
Well, we started out trying to feed our family, myself and my three adult children here. We've been working on feeding ourselves, but we did pretty well, and we're in the city. So this in Southern California, they have a lot of these trendy restaurants, so we were able to convert some of our surplus vegetables and produce into cash so we can buy stuff that we can't grow on the farm here. So there's a little bit of a side business. It's when it's up and down like this to this year, the side business has to suffer, but we still feed ourselves. You know, that's what the blessing is.
Yes, indeed. Well, I want to get back to the sort of big picture of what this all means, but can we start with a few tips? There are people out there who want to do what you're doing. Let's start with the basics, which is soil. How should we prepare city soil and make it so it's productive year after year?
Right. Well, that's a good question, and it depends on what soil you start with. We started with sort of a, like an adobe type soil that became hard as a rock when the sun would bake it, and so we had to amend it a lot. We started composting almost 25 years ago when I bought the property. We wouldn't throw away any of our waste, especially our kitchen waste. We would bury it, and it came home that the soil got better. Some places are better than others, but in the city, you know, you have to take, you can't do too much. You're stuck with what you have. And so we've basically composted everything that we could ever get our hands on. And so much as we brought in wood chips from the outside, and people throw away, here they throw away straw, hay bales that they use for decoration around Halloween and Thanksgiving. We go and collect that, and we add to the soil. Now, you can purchase organic mixes now, which we didn't have to have available a couple of years back, but now they're available at nursery centers if you get the organic compost.
And some people, they're just renting, so they don't have a lot of choices, and they've got big asphalt driveways and paved patios. Can they still use that space?
Well, yeah, that's what we have that too. That's what we started out with. We had a big 40-foot by 40-foot slab in the backyard. They used it as a business. He had a trucking business, so the person we bought the house from. And we stuck with a lot of concrete, a lot of places that are small. We turned to container gardening, and they have a new container gardening situation now where they have self-watering pots and self-watering boxes. And so you can start a little mini garden on decks, on patios, and on concrete areas. And you can definitely get some salads and some, these tomatoes and stuff that is, you know, very good for homegrown produce. You know, you can get that right away without the land. Now, if you're fortunate enough to have some land, even along the fence line, you can grow beans, pole beans, and squash along the fence line. So you're got to use all available space, but definitely look into containers.
And it must take a lot of water to grow so much, especially in Southern California. Can you give us any tips about your water management?
Yes, the watering situation here is a challenge, always will be, looks like, until we get enough rain. But one of the things we do is we plant closer together than you see out in the fields. The fields spacing, when they you know, normally give you the spacing in the books, how far apart to space the plants, that's basically for tractors and running equipment down the rows. We plant closer together, so we hope to have the leaves touch to form a canopy, which would then shade the ground below it and create a microclimate so that there's some cooler and damper weather below the surface. And we're trying to do what they call a food forest. So you want to get as close as you can without getting too much, too damp. And so it's a lot of experimentation. But what we do is water in the mornings or in the evenings so that there's no evaporation. And we hand water, and we also use what they call ollas. I don't know if you've seen that on our website.
No, I haven't seen it.
But they're old. They're clay. There's an old form of drip irrigation, about 2,000 to 3,000 years old, that they plant a unglazed clay pot in the ground, and they fill it with water, and it seeps out as needed. So it saves overhead watering, and it goes right to the drip zone of the plant underneath the. In the root zone, and it's underneath the plant real close by, so it just feeds that plant, so you don't have many weeding problems too. So it's a good form. We're heavy into conservation of water since we don't have much. Now other people, they obviously have the opposite problem. They have too much water, so you know it's always a challenge.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with Jules Dervais and more secrets of food self-sufficiency even from a small city lot. This is Co-op Radio Vancouver, 100.5 FM, a little left on your dial.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
If you are listening to Jules Dervais on Radio EcoShock, with his three adult children, the Dervais family raises inspiring amounts of food right in the city, and this could be the way we feed ourselves in the future, I think. What is the value of doing this for people? It's got to be bigger than just feeding yourself, as important as that is.
Right. Well, it began just, you know, that personal need to take care of your own needs and getting your food directly, you know, instead of going through all the middlemen and who's your farmer and where is your farmer and what are they, how are they farming? This was an empowerment process of taking back this in our own hands, which we lost over the centuries. But it's gone more than that, because what we've done is change our lifestyle from city people disconnected from nature. And now, I mean, we are so in touch with nature. We're watching nature all the time. You know, when it's like your future is bound up with our connection with nature. So you have to take care of a lot of things that you never thought you'd let somebody else take care of. You know, you let maybe the experts take care of. And now it's become, you know, myself and my children's lifestyle to just change the way we live and how we can survive for the future.
Yeah, well, your website says Path to Freedom. You have an award-winning short film on YouTube called Homegrown Revolution. It sounds deep and political, social change. How does that come from growing your own food? Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, well, you know, food being the essence of life, you can't get any more real than that. And we took back control of that. See, it had escaped us over the years by the generations. My parents let go of it, and then I was letting go of it when I was in college. You know, I had no idea that I would want to, you know, do this for a living, you know, this is my life. And it also has now freed us from all the other political powers and corporate powers that are out there. We look at it as weaning ourselves back to a strong, self-reliant family, the way the nation was founded, and how people became strong in the past. They were strong units, individually strong, and they formed a strong nation. So this is the real, you know, politics of this is that the strength is in the individual growing their own, and in a family situation growing their own food. It's like you become now a core, a cell that is very strong, and that you can build a strong units around that too, you know, if you get a bunch of people doing the same thing.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze in just a couple more tips for people who want to do it. To get so much production from your city lot, you must be using vertical layering. Can you talk to us about some of the plants you grow and how they fit in with one another?
Okay. Yeah, well, certainly with such a small space, we have to take advantage of everything that we have. So we even grow produce down our driveway, down our fence line, in the front yard. We do a lot of use of arboring and trellising. So I mentioned before that we use fence lines are critical. Plants grow up. Some are vining plants. So we have a lot of grapes that give a shade at the same time that we had a good harvest of grapes. It's a challenge to see if you can grow not just horizontally but vertically. Now, in on a field, you get your choice of all the spaces that you want. But in a city, you have to look at it like, well, how about above here? So if you see a picture of my place, which we have a lot on the internet, and plus on Google, you can Google us, you know, and see where we how we live. But a lot of it's on the vertical space. So plus I told you about the containers. We tuck containers in around, even in shady places. We can get some produce out of the shade. So we're using the whole lot, sides of the lot. You have to be able to determine where the plant grows best. So the best thing you can do is to have a mobile space. So sometimes the container gardens are your advantage. They're not limited to the ground. So you can kind of move them around and see where they thrive, see where they do best. And it's always an experiment like that.
Well, you raised the problem of global weirding, and I think there's two aspects of that I'd really love to get your expertise on it. One is, how do you manage your garden during a heat wave so that it survives?
Wow, yeah, we had that. We're doing it right now, by the way. You know, we've had hundreds just recently, and then what I try to do is I try to shade the plants so they don't get stressed by the heat. So what we'll do is we'll grow some tall plants that'll give a little bit of, they like the heat. I say tomatoes like the heat, and corn likes the heat, and some pole beans like the heat. And then behind it, just in a little nook behind it, I can grow some plants that need shade. They might need light, but they can't stand this blazing heat that they have. So we have to adjust it for shade. We can grow things in shade in a hot climate. So this is like a work in progress. We're always looking for ways to grow more, and one of the things to get out of the heat is to find a shading spot. Also, we have some shade cloth that we hang over beds every once in a while when it gets really, really tough out here. It'll cook the plants with the blazing sun, so we'll put a shade cloth on top of the beds.
Right, and another problem that can come up for other folks in other parts of the country is they think they're doing fine, but suddenly there's this really strong, gusty wind is threatening to blow everything down and everything over. Any ideas for that one?
Fortunately, we don't have that too much, except in the spring and in the fall. Most of the time, we don't have weather in the Southern California that's known as, kind of like no weather at all here, just hot or hotter. You know, that doesn't have much wind. So what we have, and we're in a city, so we don't get these, we have wind breaks. So there, it's not like living out in the country where the wind picks up over miles and miles and miles and can really cause you trouble. Yeah, I don't have the experience with the wind, but we do have block walls, fences around. And we do have our own windbreaks. I know in the open fields of the prairies and everything, they would plant trees as windbreaks to cut the force of the wind. You slow it down. You'll probably never eliminate it, but you'll slow it down. So, yeah, you can tuck things around around the buildings. The building acts as a windbreak. So if it's a windy side, then you grow something on the other side of the, take it out of the wind. Or build yourself some sort of break, like of a fence of bamboo or something like that, a bamboo reed fence. You can slow the wind down. I don't know if you can completely eliminate it, but you can slow it down. And then we trellis our plants. We put in stakes so we keep them upright so they don't. They also have support so the wind can't blow them down.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Jules Gervais, a pioneer in developing a sustainable way of life in the city. Jules, what should listeners know if they hope to get a little extra income from surplus produce?
Okay, well, that would be great if you could do that. What I first would suggest is they grow what they needed for themselves. Like, if you grow what you like, first of all, and if you're fortunate enough to have some neighbors and some extended family, or maybe a church group, or at work that you belong to, you can start to get some of your produce into that arena by asking them if they would like to buy from you. So we didn't have that situation here, so we went to the restaurants here in Southern California because there was a lot of restaurants. But if you're able to have neighbors that would buy from you, or your family, share the produce with your family, then definitely get them on board, and they'll love you for it. And they'll ask you for it, so you can almost be guaranteed that they'll want more. Then, if you do better there, you can maybe go out and try a local small family type restaurant, no big chains, but you can see if they would want some of your fresh produce. And if you're in a area like we are, the trendy area, they love this stuff. I mean, this they can't keep enough of it on the shelves. This is the trend today: local, fresh, organic. And you can fetch a premium price. So what we do is we don't grow volume, but we grow enough small stuff, but that is so valuable that we can raise the price on the produce, that we call them heirloom specialty crops.
And as you know too well, in California, as the economy sours, literally millions of people are starting to think homegrown food is better than money in the bank. Tell us about the resources you offer on your website and maybe how to use them.
Okay, well, we have quite an extensive list of website sources that you can use. First of all, our blog is called littlehomesteadinthecity.org, and that's like a daily journal of all the problems we face and how we're doing. But we also have social networks, free social networks called freedomgardens.org, which then connects you with basically sometimes you don't know it, but you might be talking to one of your neighbors in your backyard that share their information. So I might not be able to tell you about the weather up there, but certainly somebody on Freedom Gardens might be able to be helpful. We also have a part where we use barnyardsandbackyards.org, and that's for people that want to keep animals in the city. We have a store called urbanhomesteadsupply.com. That's something that you can find out what we use on the farm here. We can get you in touch with the produce and the products that we use. And then, of course, our film, Homegrown Revolution, that you mentioned, that's always inspirational to get everybody up and wanting to plant. Oh, yeah, and then, okay, the main one is urbanhomestead.org.
Right, okay, well, that's quite a list. What I'm going to do, I'm going to put it in my blog as well at ecoshock.info. So, listeners, if you didn't manage to write that down, but certainly if you start off at urbanhomestead.org, you're going to get somewhere. Jules Gervais, life keeps on changing. What is coming up for you and your family? Do you have some new projects in mind?
Well, right now we have this problem. We've had too much compost, so we're just maxed out our place. We've got a mound of compost that is needs getting to, and we're trying to find more people that are in this area locally that want to share. We have a front porch farm stand that if they have produce, we can offer it as you know, exchange for something else. So we're kind of sharing our way of life on the front porch. And then the next thing would be for my grown children to actually do this themselves. So we're looking at a community of like-minded people that want to do the same lifestyle that we're living and maybe do it 365 days a year, 24/7 days a week. We're trying to change the way we live. And so the next step would be more like getting a community together.
And as we wrap up, is there any message you really want to leave with our listeners?
Oh yeah, I would say start something now, because you never know where it's going to take you. Sometimes people maybe delay it; they might not have the perfect circumstance, and nobody does have it. So you have to start. That's first of all, and then stay with something. There's adversity along the way, and there's problems along the way, but you get to choose your problems. I mean, there's problems in the world, problems on the stock market. This way of life has problems too, but you stay with it, and hopefully you become smarter. And share with others. That's what we're looking for, is a common spirit of sharing, like they did in the old days, the old spirit of, you know, it's the neighborliness and people helping each other, not waiting for an agency or a corporation or government or anything. It's more like self-reliance, and definitely go out and be in touch with your own family and then with your neighbors. So we're looking for everyone to start sharing.
It's always a pleasure to hear from leaders and innovators in any field. And when it comes to food self-sufficiency in the city, that is the Gervais family. There's Jules, Justin, Anais, Jordan. And to find out more, you can go to urbanhomestead.org. Jules Gervais, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, Alex, I enjoyed it. I hope to talk to you again. And I wish you well in everybody's and also everybody in their endeavors, too.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith at EcoShock.org. This is Radio EcoShock on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM.
The massive fires that are blazing across central and eastern Texas.
The weather is haywire over much of the nation tonight. New York and New Jersey were hit with a tremendous amount of rain, up to 3 inches in 1 hour.
Record storms, record droughts. Radio EcoShock listeners know the climate is out of control. We see the energy system and the financial system going into a long, bumpy road that could lead to collapse. But maybe you don't know we're running out of a key fertilizer feeding the population bubble. And are you a member of a common security club? Or can money survive the end of growth? I'm Alex Smith, and we're about to explore all that with someone who knows. Richard Heinberg was among the first to explain peak oil to a world audience in books like The Party's Over and Power Down. Now the senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Heinberg pops up everywhere in documentaries and mass media. He's just done a whopping number of interviews about his new book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Trying to pick up what others miss, Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's very good to be with you, Alex. Thanks.
Richard, the last time we talked, it was about the almost inevitable blackout of fossil civilization when coal becomes too hard to find or too expensive to mine. I think you found another serious and surprising threat in your new book, namely the bottleneck of phosphates. What are phosphates and why should we care?
Well, phosphate is important to agriculture as nitrogen, and when farmers apply fertilizer to their field, usually they're applying a mixture of nitrogen, phosphate, and some other nutrients. But phosphate is, unlike nitrogen, it can't be introduced by, let's say, planting legume crops or doing crop rotation. It's mined as rock, and the U.S. reached peak phosphate 20 years ago, so we're importing a great deal of the stuff. Most of the phosphate rock being used internationally these days comes from Morocco, and we're likely to see world peak phosphate within the next 10 or 20 years, and we really have no plan B in terms of global civilization.
Did you happen to look into the results of phosphate mining? Because it leaves a lot of uranium waste. That's another problem with it. I wouldn't expect everybody to know about that. I just happened to research it in the 90s, and there's tons of it in Florida. Just for your information, it's called phosphogypsum, and there's more radioactive waste from phosphate mining piling up in Canada and now in Africa. It's just one of those problems that nobody talks about, and it's part of this whole picture of fertilizers.
Right. As we move away from natural cycles, we end up with all of these environmental problems.
Let's get back to the bigger issue, and this is in your book, The End of Growth. What happens if we can't get enough phosphate or we just can't afford to buy it?
In that case, we end up with peak food, which, of course, is going to be even more serious than peak energy, because we can do with considerably less energy, particularly we in the already industrialized countries. But having less food is going to be much more problematic, given the fact that we have a growing population. It's true that there's a lot of food waste in the system, and we could make our distribution of food much fairer and more efficient. However, the reality is that we're already seeing food supplies stretched to the limit around the planet, and food prices are already a serious problem in poor countries. That's one of the factors that led to the uprisings in North Africa and in Middle East earlier this year. So the reality of peak food, I think, is getting less and less theoretical all the time and much more of a worrisome prospect.
True. It looks like we could hit peak agriculture soon if we haven't already. Well, in your book, The End of Growth, the subtitle is Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. So using that peak phosphate example, what can we do to recycle this key fertilizer?
Well, the word recycle is key here, because we can't replace phosphate. What we have to do is recycle it through animal and human wastes, and also use agricultural practices that make phosphates that are already in the soil more available to plants. That means promoting forms of agriculture that don't kill the soil, that actually promote microbial life within the soil, because that microbial life actually makes the nutrients in the soil available to plants. As we rely more and more on adding chemical fertilizers to the land, what that essentially does is break down the microbial life, and our plants become sort of like junkies. You know, they rely on this human-supplied fix rather than being able to access the minerals and nutrients from the soil.
And I read in the journal Bioscience, there's an article there called Peak Phosphorus, and it said that some cities in Sweden are already requiring toilets to divert the urine to reclaim waste phosphorus. Man, America seems a long way away from that conversation.
Yes, well, we may go back to the days of the venerable outhouse in the future, only they may be more sort of high-tech outhouses that are capable of recycling waste.
Let's move on to something else that you've covered in your book. I'd like to cherry pick another good example of adapting to an economy that has already overdosed on growth. Richard, talk to us about common security clubs as a solution.
Right. This is an idea that sprang out of a think tank in the Eastern United States Institute for Policy Studies. They've since been renamed as resilience circles. So if you want to find out about common security clubs, you might Google either that term or resilience circles. Basically, it's just a way of encouraging folks to get together with their neighbors and talk about their common economic problems as our global economy goes into contraction. Especially us Americans, we have this tendency to personalize our economic problems, to think that, you know, if we're out of work or if there are massive layoffs, something like that, it's all our fault, it's all our problem, and it's up to us to deal with it individually. The reality is that the economy is fundamentally flawed, and a lot of people are going to be hurt by this. And if we're going to respond, we're going to have to do it as communities, as neighborhoods. And so common security clubs or resilience circles are a way of getting people thinking about economic issues in a bigger way and talking about them with their neighbors.
Richard, we've seen extended families almost demolished in North American corporate culture because jobs cause people to move around so much. There were statistics that people were moving every 3 years to a different city, a lot of people. And if you don't want to join the local church, it can be hard to find mutual support these days. Can we rebond without those older institutions?
Well, I think we can. Another way that this is happening is through transition towns, which bring together things that are usually already happening in communities, local food systems, rideshare networks, car share networks, and so on, and get people talking to one another again and also sharing stuff. Tool libraries are a terrific idea for helping people, you know, gain access to, say, gardening tools and other repair tools that they don't necessarily need to own themselves. It knits communities together and gets people sharing. And sharing is going to be a really key element in our adaptation to this new economic reality. Over the past few decades, we've been encouraged to buy more and more stuff. So every family has its own washer and dryer, its own lawnmower, its own you name it. This was beneficial to a growing consumer-based economy. But in a contracting economy, in a world of peak resources, we're just not going to be able to do that anymore. We're going to have to share a lot more.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book, The End of Growth. Richard, this book made me question some basic assumptions, and here is one. The whole banking system is based on the idea that money can multiply endlessly. We have compound interest, and capital is supposed to grow. My question for you, can money survive the end of growth?
I don't think our current money can survive the end of growth because we have a debt-based money system. Every U.S. or Canadian dollar in circulation right now represents that amount of debt somewhere in the system. How we got to that point is sort of a interesting story that I tell in the book. I won't go into that now, but we really have to get away from debt-based money because those debts imply the requirement to pay interest at some point. As long as the economy is growing, then more loans are being taken out, more money is being created, and therefore interest can be paid off and everything goes along just fine. But if the economy stops growing, as it's doing now, then suddenly a lot of interest payments can't be met and we see massive defaults. And again, that is what we're starting to see. That's why we're seeing the banking problems in Europe. And I think we'll see the banking problems reemerge here in North America. So we have to get away from debt-based currency, and there are plenty of models around for how that can be done with mutual credit clearing systems, local currencies, and so on.
And I've got to be honest with you, Richard, when anyone starts talking about economists, my mind kind of turns off. Millions of people have lost faith in these experts now that their plans and predictions are falling apart. Who is going to replace the academics and the politicians who are still right now praying hard in that church of endless growth and telling us that's the answer? Who's coming up to replace them?
Well, you know, there's been a school of ecological economics for, 20 or 30 years, and these folks have not gained much traction in the world of conventional economics, but they have made some very significant points that I don't think can be refuted. They point out that conventional economics has some fundamental flaws embedded at its very core. The idea, for example, that the environment is a subset of the economy. It's just a set of resources that we extract and turn into useful products to sell. The reality, of course, is that the entire human economy is just a subset of the environment. If we have no environment, we have no economy. Herman Daly has been talking about these issues for many years, and there are a number of other important ecological economists around the world who are bringing issues to the fore about peak resources, the need to transfer to a non-debt-based currency, and so on. So they're being proven right with every passing day that conventional economics has it wrong. And the principles of ecological economics are all laid out pretty clearly in textbooks and popular books, so it just needs to become the mainstream.
Richard, through your books, the Post-Carbon Institute, your many speeches, you must be one of the most plugged-in people on the planet. I'm wondering, how do you survive that intense throughput, all the information all the time? How do you handle it personally?
Oh, well, I spend a lot of time in our backyard garden with our fruit trees and garden beds and chickens, and I also spend a lot of time making music. I play the violin, mostly chamber music, classical music, and play with friends. And I think that's the kind of pastime that is going to get us through to the next era, depending less and less on electronic mass entertainment, which just sort of jangles our nerves and leaves us as consumers of images and sounds, and gets us back to being, you know, producers of music and art, and participants in the intellectual life of our community.
I really like that answer. Surely part of the learning process for any author is the feedback, the further growth after you publish. What have you learned from the reaction to your new book, The End of Growth?
You know, I think I've learned that the book is still, even with all that we've seen over the past 4 years with the economy, it's still a bit on the leading edge. We put a lot of effort into getting mainstream media attention on this book, and it's been very difficult because the mainstream discussion is still very much about how we get back to growth and the idea that we're not going to get there, that growth in conventional GDP growth is just no longer available. It's still just too big a stretch for most media outlets. So it's a bit of a tough slog. And I have to say I'm surprised because the signs are everywhere that this is what's happening, that we have we've reached the limits to growth.
As we wrap up, if you met a longtime friend on the road, and I think many of our listeners count on you as a longtime friend, what is your parting advice? Is it time to leave the old economy behind? Should we leave, or should we pull harder where we are?
Well, of course, it depends on each person and where they are, but I have to say I think it's really important right now that we develop local resilience and detach ourselves from the global economy as much as we can, as fast as we can, because it's a ship that's going down. And this is controversial advice, because if everybody becomes more self-sufficient and consumes less and saves more, the result is that causes the economy to contract even further and faster. But the reality is that's what everyone needs to be doing right now, because that mainstream global economy is going nowhere.
You have been listening to Richard Heinberg. Find him at richardheinberg.com. And by all means, subscribe to his free monthly called The Muse Letter. I do. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
I'm Alex Smith. Find this interview and tons of free radio downloads at ecoshock.org. And as always, thank you for listening and thank you for caring about your world. Thanks to my friend Vast Mandana on SoundClick for this little bit of end music.